Welcome to a World of Good podcast. I'm Nate Tapman.
And I'm Andrew Gale.
And we are two friends
who love Jesus,
care about the church,
and travel the world to share stories of people who do the same.
Our conversations happen in all kinds of places,
like a coffee shop in an airport terminal,
or even the back of a crowded taxi.
But no matter where we go, from Argentina to Zimbabwe,
we capture stories of the good God is doing around the world.
And we hope those stories will do you a world of good.
Welcome to a World of Good podcast. My name is Nate Tapman, and I am here with my co-host, Andrew Gale. Andrew, we're back together again. It's been a few episodes.
Yes. Yeah. We're not back together again, geographically speaking. You mean back together again.
Correct.
Yeah, in audio terms.
Yes.
In audiological terms.
In audio terms.
Yes.
We are doing this intro together at the same time.
Yes, we are.
I tell you what, I am really excited about today's episode. But before we go there, why don't you let our listeners know on where and how they can contact us or follow us?
Yeah, we always want to let you know about ways that you can connect in and learn more or ask questions. There's lots of ways to connect. So you can sign up to get new episodes in your email inbox. You can do that at our website, which is www.choggloble.org, and then just do /A World of Good, all one word. That'll take you to our webpage where you can find out information about the show, about Nate and I, connect with us on our socials from there. We also post information about the podcast on our Global Strategy Facebook page, so make sure you like us there. We have an Instagram and a Twitter account for A World of Good. At Instagram, you just search for A World of Good Podcast. With Twitter, the handle is just A World of Good Pod. We'd love to connect with you on those socials as well. So thanks for those that do reach out to us. We love to have conversations about global engagement and what it looks like for us as Christians to share the hope of Christ around the world. And if you listen to us on Spotify or Apple Podcast, whatever platform it's on, make sure you subscribe, write a review. We're grateful for the reach that this podcast is making and the ways that we're able to be in conversations with people who are passionate about the work God's doing around the world in all kinds of different places. But we would love to continue to reach more and more people, and subscribing and writing reviews is one of the ways that that can happen. So Nate, tell us about kind of where we are, what brings us to this conversation today. It's the final episode of our third series that we've done for season 3.
Yeah.
Lots of threes in this. This is very Trinitarian. The third episode of our third series.
And we are winding things down for this season. And I believe this is one of the most convicting, challenging, inspiring series that we've had.
Absolutely.
You know, the first episode, so if you're just now listening, we really encourage you to go back 2 episodes to Barbara Jones, where Andrew and I had the opportunity to interview her and talk with her. She is the director for Walking Anew, and just gave us kind of a 30,000 foot view of what missions in the Black church looks like, and gave us some stats and stories and things to think about. It was convicting for me. And I think I've shared that on multiple occasions. So, and we're going to have a chance to kind of talk through some of those convictions today. On our last episode, we spoke with Stephen and Peggy Beverly. They are missionaries in Sri Lanka, and if you listen to that, you will also have learned that they are, correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, are they the first and only Black Protestant missionaries serving in Sri Lanka? Is that correct?
They're the only. I don't know if they're the first, but they're the only currently, the only, yeah, Black missionary serving in Sri Lanka of any denomination.
Of any denomination. So they gave us just a great perspective on their personal experiences and growing up in the Black church in the U.S., going onto the field and being on the field. And so again, if you haven't listened to that, please go back and listen to that. As we mentioned, today is our third installment of this miniseries. Andrew, you want to introduce our guest for today?
I am so excited to have this opportunity to have this conversation with Keith Spencer. Keith and I met over 20 years ago, which is crazy to think about.
Ooh.
I know.
That makes me feel old.
Because I graduated in 02, and it was probably my sophomore, junior year, somewhere right in there that we met over the summer. So that puts us at least 2000. So yeah, over 20 years. We're old. We're getting very old, Keith. And the way that we met Keith was...
Man, if you guys are old, where does that put me?
Well, I'll let you self-identify how old you are. We'll let that be your own experience. I got to know Keith. His dad was a pastor in Wichita. Our youth group was going on a missions trip, and my youth pastor reached out, and Keith joined us on a missions trip. We spent lots of time then after that, engaged in youth group activities, camps, all kinds of stuff. But that missions trip, you get to know people really well on short-term missions experiences, but especially when the way that our youth group did it, we drove in vans from Wichita, Kansas to Monterrey, Mexico. So this was like a two-day drive. And when you're cooped up in a van with people for that amount of time, you get to know people on levels that you may not want them to share all the things that you learn about on those levels. So anyways, Keith and I had lots of fun with those experiences, getting to know one another. And Keith's worked as a pastor, as a church planter. He's a pilot. He has all kinds of incredible things that you could learn. We could talk about Keith. He was a radio DJ, probably not a DJ. You call it a DJ?
Radio DJ.
DJ, wow. Radio DJ works. So his radio voice, I mean, Nate and I could lose our jobs pretty easily on this podcast.
I know.
And now I'm so grateful. You know, Keith is working with us here at Global Strategies. One of our missionary specialists, Courtney Rice Alford, and Keith support our missionaries in the work that they do. And so I'm so grateful that I now get to spend even more time with Keith on a weekly basis, supporting the work that God's doing around the world. And Keith recently has been going through some old pictures, and he'll every once in a while send pictures on text messages from our time growing up in youth group. And I keep thinking all of these are maybe not incriminating photos, maybe that's a little strong, but there are certainly photos that could be used against me. And so I always wonder if this is some kind of like, this is what I have. Like, he's like,
They're great pictures to keep in your back pocket.
That's
especially when Andrew's my boss. So, I mean, you know, it works in my favor.
Oh man. But, it's incredible how God brings people into your life. And it's so fun to see those relationships change and grow and be, you know, re-engaged in the future, because Keith and I went to college together, but then there are many years where we were doing different things in different places. And now to have the opportunity to serve together in this way is just an incredible blessing for me. So Keith, before we kind of jump into this conversation today, I would love for you to give a little bit of context for your background, you know, where you grew up, some of those kind of pieces that would help our listeners get to know you a little bit better. But I also just want to put this out there. I know we know this, but I just want to say this so that this is, you know, really clear. We've invited you to come and help us process information that we've been talking about for these last two episodes, but you are in no way expected to or speaking on behalf of all Black male Christians, you know, in this context. Like, we want your voice because your background and your experience can help us understand better some of what we're processing right now. But we also want you to feel comfortable sharing, knowing that you are not speaking on behalf of everyone. And Thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for being here today for this conversation. And yeah, Keith, tell us a little about yourself so that we can get to know you as we start this conversation.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Andrew and Nate. It's awesome to be able to be part of this podcast. I'm an avid listener.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Exactly. So no, it's awesome to be able to be here. If you try to peg me, I'm kind of like that square that you try to fit into a round hole that doesn't always work. Kids, my dad was from Barbados, my mom from Trinidad and Tobago. When I say the youngest of four kids, there is a 16 to 20 year gap between myself and my three eldest siblings. And so I kind of grew up like an only child, but at the I called it the best of both worlds. And so I grew up in Springfield, Massachusetts. So first generation American, I grew up in a very racially diverse neighborhood. I mean, when I say racially diverse, I'm talking the neighbor across the street from me. And to my right, we're Black. The neighbor kind of catty corner was white. I have a Hispanic neighbor. I had that was the context in which I grew up. And so I grew up very passionate about diversity and experiencing diverse cultures and diverse relationships. When we talk about even my church that I grew up in a very heavily Jamaican church is how I grew up. And so basically my first 10 years or so of living, my dad was a pastor at a Church of God congregation in Hartford, Connecticut that was primarily Jamaican. And then we moved to, in 1995, we moved to Wichita, Kansas, where my dad where my dad pastored a African-American church. And so I grew up in that context there. And then, you know, by I would say 3 or 4 years in, I got really, really kind of sick of being the pastor's kid at that small location of church. And I actually, come to think about it, I actually dealt with a lot of cultural barriers in that transition. I never thought about this way, but in that transition from a Jamaican church to an African-American church, I dealt with a lot of cultural differences that I wasn't even aware of that caused me some challenges. And so, and I used to always just say it was because I was a pastor's kid, but as I process it now, I think a lot of it was cultural differences within the African-American within the Black context, I should say. And so it didn't quite fit in at that church. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my dad was very passionate about racial reconciliation within the church and trying to go towards that. I no longer use the term racial reconciliation now because I don't know that you can reconcile something that's never been reconciled. Mm. But he was very passionate about trying to bring together churches throughout Wichita, especially of a diverse nature. And so we arrived at this mostly all African-American church. And one of my dad's big controversial moves was to hire a white associate pastor just to try to go ahead and bridge that gap. And so he hired somebody from Western Kansas. Wow. that rolled a lot of heads, but it was a great, great move. And so with that background, I then began to just do what I'd always done my entire life, which is embrace friendships with people from a different culture. And so did that all through middle school, throughout high school. And that led to me deciding to go on different trips. So I went to a couple international youth conventions with the Church of God, one in 1998 with Central Community Church in Wichita, Kansas. And we just went with one of my friends from high school had invited me to go with her church to the convention. So I did that. And then the following summer, I got this phone call from Andrew and I's youth pastor, who basically said, "Hey, I was hanging out with you and back in when you were in eighth grade, and we were at this big kind of church gathering, and I didn't even remember who he was, but he basically called up and said, 'Hey, I'm the youth pastor of a very, very white congregation, a very white youth group, and would love for you to join us on a mission trip to Mexico.'" And I was crazy enough, looking back on it then, to say, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that." And so I showed up. Most people thought that I was the adult, another adult counselor.
You are very tall. You're a very tall person. And so you could pass as
I probably could, even at that age. Yeah. Even at that age. Looking back on pictures, I guess I could maybe have passed as an adult counselor. It's great because I think that's flipped now. I don't think I look at my age now, which is great. But anyway, I showed up and sat in the back of a van and knew nobody else on this trip except for Shane, who claims he knew me, and I believe that, but I didn't remember who he was. And so I just, looking back on it, as an African American person to drive 20 minutes through the populated areas of Wichita, it's since filled in, but to drive 20 minutes up to Andover, Kansas, which was driving through wheat fields at the time, to this very country rural church with a very white youth group.
To go spend a week with them in a foreign country. I mean, the kinds of risk and like that's a huge step to take.
It was a huge step. My parents were probably terrified, but I did it. And you know, like Andrew had mentioned in the intro, we spent a lot of time together in a Ford Expedition driving all the way down to Monterrey, Mexico, and you get to know people quite a bit during that trip. And so basically that was my foundation. And I wanted to highlight that because that's how I enter this conversation, is having that background. Since then, at that point in time, I ended up going to Anderson University for college, spent a lot of time there. I did numerous Tri-S trips that took me to different parts of the world on mission trips. I had also traveled back and forth to the Caribbean pretty regularly. I have family that's all over the world, family all throughout the UK, all throughout Caribbean, throughout Canada. And so my worldview was shaped pretty early on by a lot of those experiences. But a huge part of my background was this struggle, even within my own identity, of realizing that I was completely different. I was pegged as one thing, but my experiences growing up were quite different than the average Black person that you would see in America. And I was getting that from both white context and Black context. And so that kind of led me to have to form this strong sense of being comfortable in my own skin, which I've developed, which is great. But it's also why it's something that I'm proud of now. But back then was a struggle as a teenager trying to figure out, okay, exactly who am I when everyone else is trying to define me as one thing. And I know that I don't I don't identify as that one thing.
So just because you brought it up, and I don't know if I would have even thought to ask otherwise, but you talked about these differences between the Caribbean Black church and the African-American Black church. Can you just name or identify a couple of those differences and what those were?
Yeah, I think attitude, I think mindset, very, very much laid back. Here's a great example. There's a certain type of style of preaching that is very prevalent in the Black church here in America, kind of like the hooping mentality when you preach, and it's a certain way, and you'll see it of like, you know, you think of T.D. Jakes, for example. That's kind of become the popular style of preaching that is often mm-hmm. taught in the Black church. My dad was not a hooper and holler. That was not the context. That was not something from the Caribbean. And I think that was something that even our church back in Wichita had to struggle to adapt to, is that wasn't the way my dad was very much, I think I get my comfortability in my own skin from him because my dad was very much, this is who I am, deal with it. And so, I mean, I think that's part of it. You know, that the context of people like to stereotype, well, this is how you're supposed to talk if you're a Black person. And I didn't quote unquote talk Black. And I got that from both Black friends of mine and white friends of mine, which I always considered to be kind of an offensive statement, you know, but what does it mean to talk Black? Well, what does it mean to talk white? You know, like, so just different things like that. And I think as we talk about Blacks and missions, I think it's just very important we have to highlight mm-hmm. these realities of the Black experience in America, because these type of things are unknown that shape, these all shape how Black individuals are going to approach entering this conversation about missions, because there's often this struggle even within Black culture. If you go back historically, I'd invite anyone listening here, if you're interested in it, Google like the brown paper bag syndrome. That's something that was going on early on in American history, where if you were darker than the shade of a brown paper bag, you faced discrimination even in the Black community. For being a darker skin. And that's something that even from a Caribbean standpoint to an African American standpoint, most of the people from the Caribbean are darker skin, darker shade of skin color than the most African Americans were here in this country. Yeah. And there's historical reasons for that, obviously, but even those stereotypes in between, those shape a lot of things, and those shape experiences of African Americans, even as they are trying to get to the field, and even as they're trying to fundraise, there's those small. Not only do we sometimes face that discrimination with the broader white American culture, we face that battle within the Black culture. Yeah. So you have that going on top of this larger thing going on, and it can become very overwhelming at times.
Andrew, I know you're going to get into in groups and out groups, but real quick before you do that, I just thought, just to address our audience, and Keith, as I heard you kind of talking through some of this stuff and your experiences, there may be times where you're listening in on this conversation and feel uncomfortable with some of the terminology or the phrases that we're using, the things that we're talking about. And I just want to tell you that that's okay.
Yeah.
The uncomfortableness is okay, probably because you've never had these discussions or conversations in your circles. And so Keith, Andrew, and I, we kind of got on a little bit and started talking through some of these topics that we're going to discuss today. And we're going to get to a point where we're being vulnerable and transparent with ourselves and how these phrases and this topic and these conversations have challenged us, convicted us. Again, I keep using that word because that's a telltale sign of where I've come from and what I'm going through. But if you're feeling uncomfortable, I just want you to know that it's okay. Because in some regards, I'm right there with you in all of this.
Yeah. Part of the beauty of this is that if you go back and listen to the first podcast with Barbara, this is a family type of conversation. And one of the beauties of being able to have this conversation is because Nate, you know, you and I have known each other for a few years. Andrew and I have known each other for a couple decades. I'm still struggling with that. but because of that relationship that's there, we can have this conversation.
Yeah.
There's an authentic relationship that's been developed between the three of us that allows and provides for these type of conversations.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful thing, but it can be uncomfortable at times, but like Barbara said, strap in, it's a family conversation at the end of the day, even though we're uncomfortable, we all walk out the door, brothers in Christ, you know?
Well, that's it. Like those family conversations, that one of the things that you can trust is that at the end of the day, if you're family, that's not going to change. Like we may have issues with the way that different people think about things, but the reality is we're a family and we're going to stay connected. So you can speak those hard truths to me and I need to hear those. And we need to be able to walk out of here and still trust that we're family. And so I think that's a great example, you know, that this is a family conversation. So I've had this book on my to-read list. You know, Nate, you mentioned the in-group and out-group idea. I've had this book on my to-read list for a while. After hearing someone in our office, Courtney Rice Alford was reading it and recommended it, I finally started it. And it's called Disunity in Christ by Christina Cleveland. And I would just highly recommend people pick up a copy and read it. There are so many pieces. You talk about convicting. There are so many pieces in there that are convicting that challenge me in the way that I think about people that are different than me and how we can be connected and in community with one another, even if we don't see eye to eye. But in the book, one of the things she talks about is an effect called out-group homogeneity. And this is when we divide or categorize ourselves into groups, which all by itself can be a problem, right? But we do this in a number of different ways, whether it's by race, gender, politics, theology, age. You know, for us, Keith and I are much younger than Nate, and so we might, you know, think differently than Nate because of that. No.
Much is what he thought I heard. Keyword, I guess. I don't know.
Just going to let that slide. I'm going to let it slide.
But we can create these in-groups and out-groups, right? And this is concerning in and of itself, but she goes on to say that we then tend to recognize these differences within our in-group, but not within the out-group. So here's a really super simple example of this. So I'm part of what we would call the Wesleyan holiness tradition, right? The Arminian thoughts in theological background. And I can wax eloquent about the differences in thinking and theology between like the Church of God Anderson and the Nazarene Church and the Wesleyans and Free Methodists, because that's part of this kind of in-group within Wesleyan theology. And I can explain some of the really minute differences between the ways they think about things. But then when I talk to my Reformed friends, I just assume that they all think the same, right? That the Reformed theology is pretty much just the same, and I disagree with it. So these are like these kind of often unconscious ways that we tend to believe that everybody thinks the same. It's also called, in anthropology, we call it essentializing, where we assume that everyone in a group is essentially the same. One of the things that I push people towards is if you're trying to think differently or broaden your perspective is to talk to someone that's different than you, right? To talk to someone that's from a different age group or a different ethnic background or a different gender, different political persuasion. You know, those can help us kind of stretch. But we have to also be cautious in that we don't then assume that that person speaks on behalf of everyone, right? That that person is a representative for everyone. So that's part of what I've been processing. How do we avoid essentializing and also build relationships across ethnic, racial, gender, age divides, the, you know, things that divide us?
Yeah, I think that's a great, great question. And, you know, I'll give you what I immediately thought about. I served for a while as on a church, rather large church in New England, in the Boston area. And one of the things that I appreciated about living in Boston in particular is the diversity that's there. Mm-hmm. I would hop on the T, which is basically the local transportation system there. You get on the T, there's a bunch of people, and I would see the average, you know, your average white person, whatever you picture when I say that. And the one thing that I could not do is make an assumption about where they were, or how they would sound, or what they would talk like, or what their accent would be. Mm-hmm. Like I could if I were in Anderson, Indiana or Wichita, Kansas, there would be a greater probability of me being correct on my assumption of somebody there than there would be in Boston. I would make that assumption in Boston when I first got to living there. And then they would open their mouth. And the next thing you know, I hear Russian or I hear French or I hear Italian coming out of their mouths. And there's a beauty in that diversity. But so I thought about that as I thought about this question. And I think one of the things that we have to do is one, recognize, and Barbara talked about this, recognize that we all have our own culture and not be afraid to embrace that and celebrate that. Mm. One of the things that I learned from serving as a youth pastor in a mostly white church in south of Boston is that everyone in that area, for the most part, had an awareness of their culture, much more so than I saw in the rural parts of the United States that I've been a part of. Mm. You know, the people were proud to be German. They were proud to be Irish. They were proud to be Italian, and they celebrated that. And when there was, there wasn't white pride. Mm. There was Scottish pride and Italian pride, and everybody joined in that celebration. When it was time to celebrate that particular group's week, I'm not going to say everyone, but a vast majority of people were happy to join in that celebration of that week or whatever, you know, whatever celebration there was. If there was a funeral, there was bagpipes sometimes, and there was, you know, kilts, and it was a great thing to experience. And so I think if we recognize that we all have a culture, as Barbara was saying in one of the earlier podcasts, and we consciously stop ourselves from thinking, and this is a hard thing because this is part of when we talk about, when we talk about systems, I know that that's, for some people, that's an automatic turnoff because they want to politicize it. But when we talk about systemic type of issues, part of what that means is we've been ingrained to think that certain people are going to be, you know, what we assume that they are. And part of this quote is that they're not. Mm-hmm. And so having to unpack that consciously and intentionally is what it's going to take to start to turn that around. But it starts with that awareness that, you know what, people are, I can't make an assumption here. The world is not as I always assumed it to be. And I think that's part of maybe the uncomfortability. And you guys can speak to that a lot more than I can, but from your perspective as white males. But I think that's part of the struggle. And I think with that probably comes a degree of uncomfortability or vulnerability. And I would love to get your guys' feedback on that too.
Well, I've been processing that with, since Barbara's interview, I've done some more research into my cultural background, my lineage, and because so much of my heritage, I think of myself as just being someone from Kansas, but that, because that's the most important part of who I am, is that I'm from Kansas. But I think that there's also like trying to understand more of my heritage. And so that's something that I've been wrestling with and trying to understand. And I don't have a lot of answers, you know, but I'm trying to dig into that so that I can have some pride in that cultural heritage and where I come from.
I think the other thing too, you know, Keith, hearing you and talking about what you were just saying there, awareness is the key to beginning to see the differences. And then I think proximity is the other key in terms of we have to be in close proximity of those different from us and able to learn and distinguish those differences. And so, you know, that's probably been one of the biggest challenges for me in my childhood and growing up. And I think I shared it in one of those episodes, either with Barbara or with Stephen and Peggy, is that, you know, I grew up in Northeast Indiana, and in our county and our city, I mean, it was primarily 97-98% Caucasian white. I mean, there was literally no diversity in terms of race. There was socioeconomic diversity and things like that. And so I had to really go out of my way in terms of to know somebody else of a different color. And now I look at our family. You know, we adopted two girls from Costa Rica, one with dark skin and one with lighter skin, a brown skin color. And so there's a lot of assumptions that people make about even our daughters based upon their skin color as well. But I've learned, I've grown, I've become aware, and it's still a process to not make those assumptions when I see, you know, like whether it's people living here in Spain now, you know, making various assumptions because you have a lot of Spaniards here, but we also have a lot of immigrants from Latin America, Central America, South America, that sort of thing. And so I still cannot make those assumptions with people that we see here in Spain. And that takes a lot of intentionality on everybody's part to come to the table and to be in close proximity of those who are different from us, and to get to the point that the three of us are at this point, but to get to that point where we can have these types of conversations, because it takes trust. It takes that relationship to be able to talk about these types of things.
And one of the things that I think is a barrier to that is just, there's natural fear. There's a fear of the unknown.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a fear of, well, I don't know. You know, we can either buy into the stereotypes of someone other that, you know, whoever the other is for us, that someone looks different than us. We can buy into the stereotypes that we see on TV. You know, I remember talking with some people when I went to, this might've been either Norway or Denmark, a random conversation I had with somebody, and part of their assumption was that all Americans were like Jerry Springer show that they would see over there, which was hilarious. But no, that's not how we all act. And so, but there was this natural fear.
You've not spent much time with my family. Who knows? I mean,
there's that natural fear based off of stereotypes that we saw on TV.
That's right.
That you know, and so for a lot of people, my assumption, I'm a 6 foot, almost 6 foot four, pretty large black individual. And so a lot of people would automatically assume, until they get to know me or until I flash my trademark smile, that I'm going to be like some rapper that they see on TV that's going to harm them. I mean, literally, like I have seen death stares at white churches, when somebody turns a corner and doesn't expect to see me because they're so used to seeing someone that looks like them. And all of a sudden I've literally seen audible gasp and I'm like, hi, you know? And so,
and you cannot flash your trademark smile. You can't flash your trademark smile with your mask on either.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I mean, there's the
COVID
issue.
COVID challenges now, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think we have to be real in acknowledging the fear that we all have, that's all ingrained in us. And that fear is what prevents us from moving forward and from, you know, not making those assumptions. And it's a comfortability factor. We all want to be comfortable. And I think we're so much more comfortable with how we've been raised and how we've been taught. And so part of the controversy with racial awakening that's happening in the United States, and this ties back into missions, is all of a sudden it's challenging the status quo, and it's challenging what we've always believed and what we've always thought to be true. And now we're discovering, you know what, the world's not quite as I always thought it was. And that's scary. But in order to progress, you know, beyond that, we've got to first at least acknowledge that that fear is there and move forward from it.
And I think we have to acknowledge that there is bias, that we are biased people, and everyone is biased. I think the problem is often that we don't want to believe that about ourselves. And so by choosing not to recognize that in ourselves, we can't actually move forward. You know, it's one of the things that we do a lot of times when we talk about cultural training for people that are going to go and serve in short-term teams. Like, it's great for them to learn about other cultures that they're going to go and connect with. But the first step is really for them to understand that they are from a specific cultural background. The reality that we think about ourselves as being normal and the starting point, then everybody else is different, rather than looking at ourselves and the way that we function in society as being very culturally shaped. And I think the same is true for bias. If we don't recognize that we have bias, we do, we automatically do, then we can't start to deal with that. If I don't recognize that when I see someone that looks different than me, that that causes a reaction in me, I can't start to deal with that because I don't believe that it's actually there.
And that's the challenge, is I think for a lot of black people, particularly here in the in the United States, we've been kind of screaming like, hey, there's a problem. Hey, there's things that need to be aware of. And the response that we're used to getting is, no, you're just either playing the victim card, or, oh no, that's not really there. Or no, I don't see that. And, you know, Nate, we kind of talked a little bit about that earlier, is I don't see that. So how are you telling me that there's something that's there that I don't see? And unless we take that position of humility to kind of go, wait a second, I'm going to accept that what you're telling me is true. I'm going to validate you and validate your experience rather than invalidate your experience and just write it off. Until we get to that point, it's kind of hard to start talking about the solutions to it if we don't recognize the problem or we don't listen to the people who are pointing to the fact that there is a problem that's there.
And Nate, before you jump into the conversation about funding, see like how I did that, how I'm leading you to the next conversation. So I'm going to talk about myself and some of the areas that I'm trying to work on. One of the things that for me is really easy is to learn intellectually what it means for me to be in relationship or connected to someone that's different than me. Like I can read all the books. I can listen to the podcasts. The head knowledge is not a problem for me. And I think that there are people that may be like me that when they want to learn about somebody that's different than them or learn about themselves, they go only to the head knowledge. And I think that one of the things we miss is the lack of exposure to actual relationships and experiences of people. Like I can hear it, I can read it, but until I see it and hear it from someone, until I experience it from them personally, I don't know that I can fully understand it. And that's where I have to step outside of what's comfortable for me because the head stuff is easy, but the heart stuff is difficult.
Well, and to your point, Andrew, again, before we start recording, Keith said he wanted to get some of our perspective, Andrew and I's perspective on what we've been feeling and experiencing through these conversations. And I told him, I said, well, you know, one of the things that comes to the forefront for me is in our episode with Barbara, how direct she was in a very real, polite, conversational way, but she was direct. And then she's using some of these hypothetical questions and examples, but she's putting my name to it. And that made it very, very real for me. Because she's talking about the assumptions that are made or the weight that I carry by walking into a room and where I'm the minority and whether it's, you know, a room filled with black people, brown people or Asian or whatever, but I'm the minority, but there's a lot of assumptions that walk into the room with me. And if I'm not aware of that, that can be dangerous. Immediately my defenses went up because I think, well, that's not me. That's for maybe some other white people, but I don't do that. And so right away I'm already making excuses that are just my own reality. It's not reality of the situation of that example and probably what has happened in times where those have been the scenarios played out. And so I immediately go to other things that we've talked about with Barbara and with Stephen and Peggy as well in terms of, you know, Keith, you brought up social systems that are in place. Well, there are systems in our churches that are in place as well that are barriers for people of color to go into missions as well. One of those being funding.
Yeah.
You know, there are statistics and there's research that shows that blacks and Latinos do not have the same chance of raising funds that white missionaries do. And so then that immediately, for me, I personalize that and think, man, you know, a little less than a year ago, we were just getting to 100% funding. And I know how hard and difficult that was. My first question through these episodes that I'm asking myself, is that because I'm white? Did my race make a difference in terms of getting to 100% funding? And I don't know, you know, Keith, you said, I think your response was, well, it didn't hurt.
It definitely, yeah, didn't hurt.
and part of it is feeling guilty, but I want to also, I mean, it's important. I think the guilt is important, but I want to move beyond the guilt because that's not constructive to stay, you know, in those feelings of guilt and that sort of thing too. But it's like, I never thought about that. I never thought that my race played a role in getting my foot in the door, the ability to speak in churches, to be able to speak with pastors. And it never occurred to me. And I've put those assumptions that my black missionaries and Latino missionaries that, hey, I got to 100%. All you have to do, you just work hard and you work the system. And I'm using air quotes around system, but you work the system and you can just get it done. Well, that's not the reality. That they the our Black missionary friends do not have the same access that I had. And so those are some of the things that I am processing, thinking through with the role that I'm in now and working with global strategy and as regional coordinators over Europe and the Middle East, what can I do to change that system or to create new systems for missionaries from Black churches, Latino churches, Asian American churches, to get to the field?
Yeah, sadly, essentially what the term is, it's white privilege. And that has become a very defensive thing. Like there's people who probably are listening to that now and your defenses just went up. But all that means, it doesn't mean that you didn't have it hard. It doesn't mean that you didn't have to work to get to who it was. All it means is that your skin color was not a barrier to you achieving the success that you had. Whereas for a lot of our Black missionaries that are trying to enter the field, that's another hurdle that they have to overcome. If they're visiting churches, I can speak to a little bit of this. I wasn't on the mission field as a missionary, but I served as a church planter for a few years and where I had to raise 100% of my salary. Wow. And I struggled with that in a lot of contexts, and I'll tell you why. One, there's the initial barrier as again, large Black man that I am going into churches to try to fundraise. One, if I'm going into a mostly white church, which is what I tried to do. Now, I must say Andrew and I's home church was phenomenal in their assistance in trying to help me with that. But that only came because I have a 20 plus year relationship with them. Other churches that I tried to make that attempt with, no luck whatsoever. And I don't want to automatically peg them as it was because of my skin color, but my skin color probably did not help in those situations. Another thing that you wouldn't think of is the concept of raising 100% of your salary is a very foreign concept in a lot of Black churches. I remember talking to certain people, certain Black friends of mine, close friends of mine, and saying, hey, would you be interested in partnering with what God is doing in my life as I try to enter ministry, and I need your help with financial support and fundraising, and I got blank stares from people. Like, wait a second, you got to do what? You're having to raise your salary? Like, they're not just gonna pay you? It was a foreign concept. I couldn't just say, well, and I actually did this a couple times. Well, yeah, it's like missionaries. Well, wait, missionaries has to raise their support? I mean, there's just, and so we talk about lack of education a little bit. Stephen and Peggy Beverly brought this up brilliantly, but that's part of it, is having to educate churches on what that means to actually have to raise support to go to the field. What does that look like? What does that mean? There's socioeconomic factors. A lot of people that I went to would say, hey, we would love to support you. We're trying to put food on our table for our kids. We don't have thousands of dollars in the bank. We're living paycheck to paycheck. And you can go throughout history and put systems in place and look at the systems that are in place that keep African Americans disproportionately lower on the financial scale. That impacts things. I think another factor is if I'm looking at churches to go to, there is the natural fear, even on my side as a Black man, of going into an all-white church and asking for funds, because I have to address the stereotype that you're just looking for a handout. Oh, well, you're just you're not working hard enough. People would never directly say that, but we all know, and maybe some of you listen would if you're humble enough, you would admit that, yeah, I kind of do think that naturally sometimes you're just not working hard enough, or yeah, you're just looking for a handout. But those are all the things that we have heard. When I say we, a lot of Black Americans have heard throughout the course of our lives. And so then there's this natural fear and hesitancy when you're trying to go out to raise support that you're going to automatically be labeled that way. Oh, well, there's Keith just looking for a handout. Keith's not working hard enough, and so he's got to raise support. Whereas in most white contexts, that's a normal thing.
Yeah.
You're going to the mission field.
It's considered sacrificial. Wow, look at them sacrifice.
Exactly.
It's given a positive spin rather than a negative
one. Than the negative thing. And so that's a barrier that you have to overcome. And that's not to say that you can't overcome it. Stephen and Peggy Beverly are a great example. They're on the field. And they've gotten past that, but that's a natural hesitancy or restriction that me as a Black person would have before I try to go raise support. And so you do that, or you go to Black churches, and again, because of and Barbara talked about this, about kind of, well, missions in the Black church, there's language differences and communication
absolutely.
Differences. You talk about the missions, well, we're trying. It's either it's either we have a connection. I served at a large church in New England, and they were involved in missions, but it's missions to Haiti, which is like, well, you know, a huge part of that church is Haitian. So yeah, we're going to go back and help our family.
Yeah.
And so it's still an inward focus of, we're not necessarily going to those people over there. We're going to our people over there, and we have issues within our own community that we need to fix. And so as we're trying to work on our local issues, okay, we'll support a little bit of missions to our extended family overseas, but it's still an inward focus and not so much a, hey, we're going to go to, you know, I don't see that you see many black Christians saying they're going to be missionaries to like Norway. Like, it just doesn't exactly happen, you know, because we're, you know, and that's not a bad thing. We have to be focused on our own issues in our own community, but that's another one of those barriers that exist that you wouldn't think about too much.
You know, and other organizations, one of the ways that they deal with this is we've had conversations with other missions agencies that actually take a percentage out of every dollar that's raised from other missionaries to support non-white missionaries. So black and brown missionaries, Asian missionaries, they will, you know, so like 1% of every dollar that comes in will go into a pot that's specifically set out to help financially support black and brown missionaries who have a disproportionately more difficult time raising support, which is really fascinating that that's one of the ways that some organizations have dealt with that disparity and the challenges that come with the socioeconomically reaching into communities that may not have the wealth to be able to support people at the level they need to in order to go and serve globally.
Yeah. And I just think that's so important to understand that. And as we start thinking about, well, what's the solution and how do we move forward on some of those things? I think when we recognize that there, one, when we recognize, again, the assumptions that we all bring to the table, two, you know, Barbara called it, cultural competency, I believe, and intercultural competency. When we start to recognize, well, there's people that have a completely different experience than I do, that people that have a different background than I do, and it's not so much, you know, I think the if I can be bold, the white church loves to throw money at problems. My experience has been it's not been so much, hey, I'm gonna actually be the hands and feet in Jesus and get into the deep relationship with you and help you weed through your own dirt. It's, hey, I'll throw money at a problem, and that doesn't help either. But going in and actually doing that hard work of building that relationship is part of the solutions. One of the things, and I know Stephen and Peggy talked about kind of a failure of imagination. One of those things that I look back on, and it's been weaved through our conversation so far. The reason that I'm here sitting at this table as a missionary specialist working in global strategy is because of the boldness of a white youth pastor who recognized my youth group is very white, and so I'm going to invite somebody who does not look like them to join us for a week, develop relationships, and these relationships have turned into lifelong relationships. And what would happen if more of our white churches did something like that? And I know that the fear is there of like, well, are we going to be misunderstood? And I know that the fear exists of saying the wrong thing or coming across strong or coming across, but if we can move past that, I think that's the biggest thing, that fear of being misunderstood or that fear of, that deep fear of accidentally being labeled racist has kept so much progress from happening because we stop at that fear and say, well, I am afraid of this, so I'm not going to move forward. Well, I wish people would just push past that and fail forward. And so if you're going to mess up, but at least let people know your heart. Yeah. And when, you know, for me, Shane probably said a lot of crazy things back then, but I recognized his heart in it. And that's what kept me going. And that's led to what I'm here. So on a practical level, what would it look like if a lot of our white churches that go on short-term mission trips all the time took that approach, invite somebody that doesn't look like you to join you for a week,
pay for
strong
it,
relationships,
pay for them to go.
And you know, that would be huge, you know, or go do a short-term mission trip to some place like Sri Lanka where there is a black missionary and serve and sit under them as they sit under the local leadership and learn that way. Because as you're doing that, you're exposing more and more people to an experience that they've not had before.
going back to our Millennials and Missions series, we spoke with Allie Hawkins. And again, we kind of looked at this report from Barna entitled The Future of Missions. And out of that, we now know that there is a generation of young Black Christians who are open to becoming missionaries, as well as other races as well. But there's this new generation of missionaries that are potentially going to be coming up through our churches. Also from that report, we know that proximity is vastly important for missionaries and going to the field. People who are connected to a missionary are also more open to becoming a missionary. And so I'm kind of putting all of this together and pulling all this together. But there's this very real kind of broken cycle, if you will, of there's a lack of Black missionaries out there in the field today. But yet, you know, we have this openness for young Black Christians to become missionaries. And so when we talk about failure of imagination, when we talk about the future missions, I don't have any answers other than to say this is also something I think we need to think through in terms of how do we bring Black missionaries into close proximity with young Black Christians who are open to missions. And I don't have the answers, but I think that's something else that needs to be addressed that we need to make sure is at the forefront of what we're processing and thinking. And partly why I'm bringing this up is maybe there are listeners out there who have some creative ways in some ways to imagine how this is possible in the local church. And that's, you know, again, this podcast has a lot of different levels and layers to it. But one of those is how can we help the local church in global missions work? And so process that, think through that and give us your feedback. If you have some ways, maybe there are some churches that are doing some of these things in a creative, imaginative way and to be able to share those with others.
I think proximity and exposure is just, it's massive on both ends. Whether it's someone like our youth pastor saying, hey, I want to expose my kids to someone different than them. Mm-hmm. And so the invitation is put forward for that person to join, or even better yet, hey, we're going to connect with a church that doesn't look like us. And we're going to, you know, we're going to start doing youth group activities together, or we're going to start going to a meal together, or we're going to serve together, or we're going to do a joint mission trip together. Yeah. Things like that help bring that relationship forward. And if you can start on a local level, because there might be churches that are, you know, pastors are listening and, hey, this sounds great, but we don't have it in our budget to be able to necessarily go overseas. Well, start where you're at. You know, if you're a rural church out there in the middle of nowhere and you know all your kids just only know other white kids, well, start going into a community where there's more Black people and develop relationships. I mean, one of the things that I love about our mission here at Global Strategy is we're all about walking alongside the local church globally. And it's about that relationship that gets developed and built, and not just a short term type of thing where money's thrown, where we throw money at it, but it's a longer term sustainable relationship that's built. And so the more that happens, the more that exposure happens, the more that proximity, the more you close the gap on the distance and proximity draws near, the better it's going to be, that because people's minds are going to be open, their hearts are going to be open to something different. Yeah. And that relation, and out of that, the Holy Spirit can do so many things. That's when God can start speaking a call of missions into somebody's life. You know, Peggy talked about that in prior episodes about how it just took her being exposed to the field for God to open up her heart and start speaking to her and saying, hey, you know what? Like there's a call on your life here to go elsewhere and to serve elsewhere. But that just starts with just this simple intentionality that is also met with action to close that gap and bring about exposure.
This whole idea that, and Andrew, I tweeted this, actually I tweeted your quote, and I don't know if you want to just kind of end with this, but the whole theology of suffering and the reason why I tweeted out this quote, because it just, as I was going through our notes or listening to our conversation with, I think Stephen and Peggy, it was just, you know, Jesus was not part of the majority culture. He was part of the minority oppressed culture. And the suffering that Jesus experienced was a minority in an oppressed culture. And so
I know you tweeted that, and I almost couldn't remember ever saying it. And so I got nervous. Like, did I actually say that? So I actually went back and listened to it. It was from Barbara's podcast. Yeah. And yeah, I did.
Okay, Barbara's.
I made that statement.
You did. You did. And it put things into perspective, you know, in terms of our faith and who we are following as Christians.
Yeah.
You know, and when we say that we are followers of Jesus Christ, we are following somebody who also did not look like me.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and he did not live in the same culture or context that I live in. And so I think, again, that's putting our faith into perspective, putting ourselves into the right context, the proper context, understanding who we are and what that looks like and what that means. I think that's so different or so important, acknowledging that difference.
I think that you're exactly right. I think that we have to think about Jesus within his context, and that Jesus was living in a world where he was not the majority culture, and also had discrimination against him and against his community and the people that he would have been connected to, and dealt with discrimination both from, you know, the Roman Empire as well as from within his own in-group, those that should know him and should understand him, you know? And so when we think about that, I think we have to read Jesus truly in Jesus's own context. And yeah, Keith, it's been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for being here, for being a part of this, and for sharing honestly about where you are. I know that, you know, for me, when we started recording Stephen and Peggy's episode, we actually recorded theirs before we recorded Barbara's. I felt like I just kept wanting so badly to ask questions that would move the conversation forward, but being so concerned with how they would be received. And I think you touched on that fear. You know, the fear is what keeps us away from making decisions that could impact us. And I am just so incredibly amazed. Like, as I think about, like, I was there when you joined our youth group to be a part of that missions trip. But now hearing you talk about it and thinking back on that, I am so amazed that you sat for a week in another country with people that, I mean, did not look like you, that didn't even know you. I mean, that's not even just the racial, ethnic, all those kind of things, but you were going with people that didn't even like, yeah. I can't imagine deciding that I'm going to go with an all African American church on a missions trip that I'd never met before. Like, that is you took a huge risk.
To a country where you don't speak the language.
Exactly, right? Where it was foreign to you. You took a huge risk. And I think that, like, God has blessed that in some really beautiful and incredible ways. And I don't know that I've taken those risks. And so that's what I'm processing now, is where am I being called to step out and take risk? Where am I being called to get outside of who I am? Because who knows what might come out of those experiences that I would never experience if I didn't just do that. And so I'm so grateful for your honesty today, because it once again has been really helpful for me as I process who I'm called to be and how I'm called to connect with, support, love my brothers and sisters in Christ from all different backgrounds and wanting to do that well. So thank you, Keith, for being with us. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. And the last thing I'll say is, for any of our listeners, there is just something incredibly beautiful on the other side of that risk. And so I just encourage everybody to jump in, dive in, and fail forward.
I love that. Fail forward.
Well said. Well said. Thank you, Keith.
Thanks, Nate.
Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. If you want to join the conversation, visit us at Twitter at A World of Good Pod, on Instagram, A World of Good Podcast, or visit our website, chogglobal.org/A World of Good. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.